they're kind of like a barracuda. They're kind of long and slender with a, kind of a long pointed snout with a lot of teeth in there, and they're voracious.
Working to wipe out the invasive northern pike from South Central Lakes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend.
And I'm Corey Flintoff.
Corey Flintoff, what are you doing here?
Well, I used to host and produce this show, so I thought I'd stop by and see how it was holding up.
Well, as long as you're here, can I interview you about the old days?
Sure.
Okay, then, an interview with Corey Flintoff and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time homebuyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's not satisfied with the explanation she received on the government's handling of a key witness in an Alaska corruption case. Murkowski requested an inquiry into the Justice Department's investigation and decision not to prosecute Bill Allen on charges of transporting a minor across state lines for immoral or exploitative purposes. In a letter to Murkowski, Assistant Attorney General Ronald Weiss says justice officials have wide discretion in deciding whether to pursue criminal charges. He said justice's internal ethics watchdog, charged with determining whether the decision not to prosecute Allen was based on improper factors, found further investigation of the matter unwarranted. Allen was a key witness in an investigation that ensnared then-Senator Ted Stevens. Stevens' conviction was tossed after the Justice Department admitted misconduct. Northern pike are native to other parts of the state, but not South Central Alaska. Biologists are experimenting with new tactics to wipe out northern pike that have been introduced to waterways in the area since the 1950s. They're also working to educate the public on why it's important not to illegally stock waterways with pike. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
Northern pike prefer shallow, vegetated water where they can hide and ambush prey. Because many South Central area lakes are shallow throughout, prey fish can't dive deep to escape and haven't evolved other defenses against the invasive species. Ken Marsh is Regional Information Officer for South Central Alaska in the Department of Fish and Game. He says northern pike have the capacity to devour huge quantities of fish.
They're kind of like a barracuda. They're kind of long and slender with a kind of a long pointed snout with a lot of teeth in there, and they're voracious. They will literally, and have literally in scores of lakes in the valley, eat every rainbow trout, every salmon in sight. And they've actually eradicated rainbow trout from many lakes where they used to be native and abundant.
Northern pike also prey on waterfowl, especially chicks and amphibians. Robert Messengill is a fisheries biologist in the Sports Fish Division of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He says the department has used rotenone, an organic compound that deprives gilled creatures of oxygen, in four lakes since 2008 and is planning to use it on Stormy Lake near Nikiski in the fall.
The cost for that is going to be just about $100,000 to buy the rotenone to treat that lake. And there's a lot of other costs associated with being able to apply the rotenone to the water, too.
Rotenone doesn't affect mammals, birds, or people, but it does kill all fish where it's applied. Biologists say in many cases that's not really a big deal because the pike have already wiped out most or all other fish species. The Department of Fish and Game restocks lakes with new fish or with fish temporarily removed, then returned after the rotenone has evaporated. Pat Shields is the Upper Cook Inlet Area Management Biologist for the Department of Fish Game's Commercial Fisheries Division. He says the department is also experimenting with other approaches, including one using a gun, sort of like a giant water pistol.
It shoots a high pressure wave of water, and you subject pike at different distances away from these water cannons to see what kind of damage they sustain.
The bigger the gun, the bigger the blast, but also the more difficult to transport and maneuver. Field says they're experimenting to determine the smallest, most effective size. Shield says the department is also collaborating with the U.S. Geological Survey and Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association to test a device similar to a low-voltage electrical fence.
There are all kinds of applications that, if this is successful, you might be able to do. You could maybe take a long electrical fence, deploy it between two boats, and, you know, drag it down a lake or tow it down a lake and use it to move all the pike into one end of that lake and then do another treatment to them there.
Biologists are also conducting an experiment involving aggressive netting of pike at two Mat-Su Valley water bodies, Alexander Creek and Alexander Lake, that biologists say were once an incredible king salmon fishery, but have been overtaken by pike. Despite all the problems with pike, Messengill says people are continuing to illegally stock local waterways with northern pike.
Hopefully, with the education work that we're doing and the penalties that people can face when they do it, that is becoming less of a problem. I think we're making some headway there.
Transport, possession, and release of live fish or fish eggs into Alaskan waters without a permit is a Class A misdemeanor, which allows the state to seek restitution for damages to the fishery and expenses for removing introduced fish. To increase harvest of northern pike, the state has increased bag and possession limits and allows several additional harvest methods. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The Permanent Fund is ready to invest $400 million toward the idea that a growing number of people don't want to own homes. The fund's trustees have approved an investment in American Homes for Rent, a company that buys packages of single-family homes, including foreclosures, and manages them as rental units. The Permanent Fund would own as much as 80% of the company that already owns more than 1,000 houses nationally. The fund's executive director, Mike Burns, says the company sees some changing demographic groups that want alternatives to a home investment.
Another factor due to the economic times that I think is weighing heavily on people is their need for mobility. Someone doesn't want to have to pass up on a job opportunity in Minneapolis because they can't sell their home in Colorado Springs. Mm-hmm. So mobility is becoming, you know, it's a factor.
Burns says the investment is part of the fund's special opportunities portfolio, saying the need for the company will exist only for a while.
It will go away, and hopefully we'll never do it again. You know, the country will never get in this type of situation again. But for a period of time, we think, you know, a window is open, and we'd like to, you know, see if we can, you know, go through that window.
Burns says the properties the company will purchase will mostly be in areas where there are large numbers of homes on the market now, saying property management needs to work on a large scale to be profitable. A final contract is under negotiations right now, and Burns says as soon as that is complete, the transaction will be finalized. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage DJ shares his craft with kids from Mountain View.
I want them to find an opportunity in life, either with music or just being in the business world.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Years before I even came to Alaska, much less started working for APRN, a young man from Fairbanks made his reporting debut at KYUK in Bethel. He then went to work as host and producer of this show, Alaska News Nightly, eventually making his way to NPR in Washington, D.C. Corey Flintoff has spent the last decade working as a foreign correspondent for NPR in the Middle East. Flintoff is back in Alaska this week, helping out APRN, this time as more of a celebrity than reporter. He says the stories he was reporting on during his early career are very similar to the stories in the Alaska News today.
There are a lot of Alaska Native sovereignty issues, a lot of environmental issues, resource extraction issues, and of course the thing that's always the daily bread of reporting in Alaska, various kinds of crime.
You said working in rural Alaska helped prepare you for reporting in foreign countries. How did that?
Well, especially at KYUK, it's because it's a kind of cross-cultural reporting. You know, KYUK, Bethel, and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta is all a big, primarily Yupik Eskimo and Athabaskan area. You observe the pause patterns of other people's language. You know, English speakers tend to pause for about 1 second, and that's your cue that it's time for you to step in and, you know, perform your part of the conversation. But for Yupiks and people in a lot of other native languages, the pause pattern is longer. It's about a second and a half, meaning that Yupik people used to often feel that we were interrupting them because we weren't respecting their pause pattern. So those kinds of cultural patterns exist all over the world. They're all different, of course, but what I learned in Bethel and in Alaska generally is that, you know, be prepared for other people to see things differently from you do, and be prepared to adapt to whatever their worldview might be.
When you then went to work for APRN after KYUK, what were some of the stories that really stood out during your tenure there?
Well, of course, you know, I mean, the big one in everyone's life here was the Exxon Valdez oil spill. You know, not only because, you know, it was this singular disaster, you know, it was this world-class disaster, but because it was a story that lasted so long and had so many convolutions to it. It was something that I don't think anybody in Alaska news media of any kind, newspaper or broadcast, had any idea how to deal with. It was simply too big. There were very few people who had the reporting experience and expertise to do this kind of thing. So we all had to learn on the fly how to represent something that was so important to our state, both locally, you know, and on a national stage, you know, and that was an enormously important story for everybody. And I think, you know, you always have to, you hate to say that a disaster was something that contributed to your own career or to your own education, but it did both for me. It taught me to be a better reporter. And it also, you know, the dirty secret of a lot of reporters' backgrounds is that there was some disaster that propelled you into the next job up. And for me, it was what made the connection to NPR.
How do you think being from Alaska and having started out as a reporter here shapes your work as a journalist today?
Well, you know, Alaska is a very cosmopolitan place. You know, I mean, much more so than you'd think. You'd think that a place that is fairly remote from the rest of the continental United States and a place that, you know, is like a large province would be parochial and provincial in its outlook. And in fact, that's not true at all, because Alaska has always attracted interesting, intelligent, you know, sort of far-thinking, far-seeing people, you know, because they come here for the adventure and they come here for the beauty of the place. You know, and so that, you know, I was reminded constantly when I'd be interviewing people in Alaska how smart people are, you know, and, you know, you can never look down your nose at anybody, or, you can't dismiss anybody, because you have to know that there are a lot of people who are an awful lot smarter than you are out there. And I've always carried that with me reporting overseas, and I've never been disappointed.
NPR foreign correspondent and former Alaskan Corey Flintoff got his start in broadcasting at KYUK in Bethel and the Alaska Public Radio Network in Anchorage. When hundreds of junk cars began taking over the Chilkat Valley near Haines this year, it prompted concern in the borough about how to deal with the problem. But coordination between the borough and a Seattle recycling company meant hundreds of junk cars and scrap metal have been removed. As part of our occasional series on recycling, Margaret Friedenauer from KHNS in Haines has the story.
There aren't many options in Haines when that old pickup or Subaru has finally succumbed to the elements, repairs, and a duct tape bumper. When residents in the Chilkat Valley have an old vehicle to dispose of, it usually ends up rusting away in a yard. But this month, the Haines Borough helped organize a collection of the junk cars and scrap metal through Channel Construction in Juneau. The company works with Skookum Recycling in Seattle to haul a barge load of metal from southeast Alaska about twice a year. Theo Kennedy is foreman at the Haines Collection site.
We take it down to Seattle and it all gets recycled, gets made into other metal stuff. They melt it all down and reuse it.
This year, the collection was bountiful. In 10 days, Kennedy's crew was overwhelmed with 400 junk cars and a massive pile of scrap metal. The collection was organized by Haines Borough Special Projects Coordinator Darcy Kolbeck. He says the borough facilitated the effort because junk cars were piling up in the valley and drawing complaints from residents.
Well, we had been contacted by residents about various properties that had a lot of junk cars on them, so we were looking into that and what the solution of getting those things cleaned up was, and so we just sort of acted as a facilitator between Channel Construction and CIA and some of the larger piles of junk cars to make sure everyone's on the same page on what could be done.
Residents disposed of their junk cars and scrap metal at reduced or no cost. Usually, legally disposing of a vehicle in the Chilkat Valley costs several hundred dollars. Kolbeck says leaving a car to languish on private property or illegally dumping it elsewhere violates borough code and also costs the owner money.
So this is a much better deal for the consumer as far as a way to get rid of those cars, once again in an environmentally sound way, but at a much less costly way.
Last week, when the collection was in full swing, recycling foreman Theo Kennedy pointed out the piles of cars and metal that had accumulated at the site near the Haines Ferry Terminal. The scrap metal pile included appliances, boat motors, old siding, and rusted culverts. Among the vehicles were mostly older models of cars, trucks, and vans. Many had broken windows and mismatched paint. Some had bumper stickers with names like Tony Knowles or Wally Hickel. A few of the vehicles that came in were still operating, like an older model white Subaru wagon. A crew member drove that one directly onto the forklift tongs that then carried the car to a draining rack as Kennedy looks on.
Yeah, every once in a while you get a runner. They're fun to mess around with.
Kennedy says the most interesting items are pieces of cars or trucks that were obviously someone's project that was never completed.
Our favorite ones are the half cars that come in, just like a cab of a truck or something. It's like, nice.
Channel Construction, the borough, and Chilkoot Indian Association helped facilitate the pickup of many vehicles and scrap metal throughout the valley. But residents, like Guy Monroe, could bring cars to the site themselves. He had a friend help him haul his 1990 Volkswagen truck to the site.
It hadn't been used for about 10 years, so it was great to get rid of it. It's a great deal, and everything's getting recycled, so.
Monroe said it was a great opportunity to clean up properties around the borough, including his own. Reporting from Haines, this is Margaret Friedenauer.
Alaska Airlines is trying out a new luggage tagging system at the SeaTac Airport. It could expand to other airports, including some in Alaska. Customers use new kiosks to weigh their own bags and print out and attach labels. Travelers still must drop off luggage with agents and show identification. Airline spokeswoman Bobby Egan says it's a small change that should save some time.
The idea here is that as our customers in Seattle gain a little bit more experience with this, this could expedite the check-in process.
SeaTac is the airline's largest hub, followed by Anchorage, Portland, and Los Angeles.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Mark Earhart. This week on AK, spinning opportunities in Anchorage. The Mountain View Boys and Girls Club is packed with kids after school. One reason they show up is music. There's a room filled with instruments and a digital production studio. Now an Anchorage DJ who grew up in the neighborhood is adding to the mix by sharing his craft. KSKA's Daisha Eaton tagged along with DJ T-Rex and has this story.
What do you want to listen to?
Spanish songs like...
Huh?
Dembow, whatever.
Okay, let's get you some dembow then.
That's Rufy Alvarez, also known as DJ T-Rex, teaching kids at the Mountain View Girls and Boys Club how to DJ. The name T-Rex was given to him by a high school buddy, he says, and it fits.
It kind of goes with my character because I'm very motivated, and the way I think of things is like you gotta be aggressive if you really want it bad.
Growing up, Alvarez wanted to be a DJ really bad. His family immigrated from the Dominican Republic to Alaska when he was 10. He says those first years adapting to the U.S. were tough. He wasn't doing well in school, and he often felt angry. But one thing made life easier, music.
The music kind of helped me to communicate better, especially at school. When it came to music, like, it helped me release all that anger.
When he was 13, Alvarez got some equipment from the Salvation Army and started throwing dance parties in his basement. He credits his school music programs, along with his family's devotion to traditional Dominican merengue, for helping him develop an ear for music that led to DJing. He says it's nice to be making money from doing something he enjoys, but there's one main reason he loves to DJ.
And me personally, what I love to do is I love to make people dance.
Having grown up in the Mountain View neighborhood himself, Alvarez says he knows the challenges that many kids at the Boys and Girls Club face. Now he's sharing his skills with students like Kayvon Pruitt, who says he wants to be a DJ too.
Playing different music is fun and it's tight. It's like a mixtape, but you're making it.
I just want to know, who want to learn how to DJ today, man? Where my fans? There you go, I see one.
Alvarez sets up his DJ equipment and is teaching another kid who calls himself DJ Trey how to use it.
Right now, what I'm trying to teach them is the basics. It's like how to phase sound from the left to the right, like bring one sound in and then bring the other sound out. So be matching pretty much, because you don't want to play two different sounds coming in with the second sound in when the other sound is different. You want to kind of play the same beats till you keep changing your groove and stuff.
Frank Steiner manages the Mountain View Boys and Girls Club. He says the purpose of the music program at the club is to give kids an opportunity to explore music avenues that are not available in school, and T-Rex is a good fit.
He's exactly what I was looking for in a DJ, to come in, teach the kids, inspire the kids, and let the kids know that they don't even have to pick up a musical instrument. That DJ equipment can be their musical instrument.
As for Alvarez, he says he just wants the kids at the Mountain View Boys and Girls Club to have fun and maybe to discover a career possibility that they wouldn't have thought about otherwise.
Especially in the community I come from, a lot of us, we either end up selling drugs or ending up in gangs. So I want them to find an opportunity in life, either with music or just being in the business world.
Opportunities that seem more realistic with Hollywood's growing interest in Alaska. He has high hopes the kids from Mountain View can add to the mix. Alvarez says he wants to find ways to use his success to give back to his community. He'll DJ a dance at the Mountain View Boys and Girls Club tonight, and he's planning to host his next event at Club Millennium on June 16th. A percentage of the proceeds from that event will benefit Boys Town and Food Bank of Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're visiting Tatitlik, a tiny village in Prince William Sound, south of Valdez.
My name is David Totemoff Sr. I'm the Native Village IRA Council President for the community.
The village is only 50 plus people counting all the kids. The kids have to understand that we are here to help one another. So I'm hoping that we can find that with one of these generations, because we lost it for a while. Before the earthquake, there was almost 3/4 of the people in the community were commercial fishermen. As the time went on, the permits were sold and people completely got out of the fishing that we all grew up with, and now we're trying to survive, so to speak. We don't have the resources at the moment, but we're working on making some different jobs happen for the kids that are growing up here so they can continue to live here instead of having to move to Anchorage or Valdez or Corova. The oil spill, I think we were fortunate that the oil went westward from the community. It never did reach in here, even though the conditions were right for the oil to move back in here, because we see icebergs float through here all the time. We're subsistence users. We live off our land. We try to make sure that there's not depleted, and the Exxon oil probably had a very, very tremendous negative effect on all of the resources that we had in the past.
That was David Todimoff Sr., Tetitlik's IRA Council President. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Daisha Eaton, Tony Gorman, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more great stories from around the state. I'm Mark Earhart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Margaret Friednauer in Haines, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. Mark Earhart was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Someone you know is likely a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans, mhtrust.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.